Hi, this is Gideon Rothstein with a response of the day for the 23rd of Iyar. Let's thank our partners, Rabbi Jack Abramowitz, David Hachhauser, and the OU for making these shiurim available to you online. And for the 23rd of Iyar, we're going to see a response of the Nodab Yehuda, what he called them Hadura Tinyana, which was like the second volume. Tinyana means the second. So the second volume. Instead of calling it bad, he just called it like, so Hadura Tinyana usually means a different edition. But it's not like he redid the Tshuvot. It's like another set of Tshuvot. You have an Ezer section. Siman Kuf Nun Tet, responsum number 159, which is dated to the 23rd of Iyar of Tuf Kuf Mem of 1780. Now, as a brief introduction, I want to point out that I don't know much about legal theory, I know a little bit because I read a tiny little bit, but there's something called formalism. So formalism is the idea that in legal theory, and there's a lot of formalism in halakha, not all, halakha is not one thing and not another, but there's a bunch of formalism in halakha. So formalism is when you say you have to follow the procedures of the law, almost regardless of the outcome. Right? It's law, and I think there's a lot of that, and a lot of other people don't realize, but that law is about, there's laws on the books, you follow the laws, you follow the procedures, you follow the ideas, you follow the details, and that's the outcome that you need to get. So we're about to see a responsum where for much of the responsum, the Nodab Yehuda is remarkably stuck in a formalistic view. Now, it's about a promiscuous sexuality issue, and I think that I haven't seen that many Nodab Yehudas, but more than enough of them have been about situations of marital problems, marital issues, that I think that might have been a topic at the time, that sexuality. This is the late 1700s, so I don't know why it was going on that way, but, and I don't know if about the time to know, but it seems to me to come up more often than I would have thought it came up, although maybe it only catch my eye, and that's something about me. I hope that's not true, but I don't think it's true. So in this case, we're going to watch the Nodab Yehuda adamantly insist that the niceties of the law have not been followed, and therefore the conclusion that the Beit Din that had turned to him is incorrect, and then we'll see him flip at the end. So we'll see that at the end. But for much of the time, we're going to watch him go way out of his way to try to protect a woman who seems to have violated the Torah. So this is the story. And he says, Alvar Isha Gomer Bat Divlaim. Gomer Bat Divlaim is a name in Hosea. Hosea is told, so in the book of Hosea, there's a woman referred to as Gomer Bat Divlaim, who she's told to marry a prostitute, and her name is Gomer Bat Divlaim. So Nodab Yehuda refers to this woman as a Gomer Bat Divlaim. So he's not well impressed with her. So what's happening is she's living with her husband, and another man lives in the house with them, and it seems fairly clear to everybody that she's having an affair with this man. So this court, this rabbinic law court that had sent the question to Nodab Yehuda, tells him that they sent a warning to the couple, to the woman and her husband, with two, you know, trusted witnesses, that they have to remove this man from the house, and all the more so that he should not be allowed to have yichud with this woman. He's not allowed to be alone with her in any possibly compromised situation. And the couple didn't care. They didn't pay attention to it. So this Beit Din has decided that since this woman is acting this way, it's like the husband had told her, had warned her. This is called kinui. When a husband says to a wife, I suspect that you're acting inappropriately, having an affair, by the way, not just acting appropriately, having an affair with so-and-so, I don't want you to be alone with him in any situation where it could be possibly true that you would have an affair, that you would have sexual relations. So in the Torah, if a husband does that, then if the woman is then seen alone with that man, even though we don't know whether anything happened, that's enough to be a problem, and halakha, that's enough for the husband to require her to accept a get from him. This court has decided that their warning to this couple was sufficient to say that it was like the husband had done so, and therefore there was time to force the husband to divorce the wife. That's what the court is saying. Now, the reason they said that is because we do have a source in the Gemara that says that a court can do kinui. So they decided that they too can do kinui. So the Nodab Yehuda first points out that what they're referring to is a Mishnah in Sotah, Daf Kaf Dalet Amud Aleph, from 24a, where the Gemara said, the Mishnah says, Ve'elu shel Beit Din Mikanin. These are situations where the court is allowed to do a kinui, to stand in for the husband and to say to the woman, you must make sure not to be alone with X man. So here are the situations they give. If the husband became a cheresh, which in the Mishnah means a deaf mute, meaning he lost his ability to communicate completely, onishtateh, or he lost his mind, so he's no longer in his right powers of mind, or he was in prison, And they can't on the basis of this, in the time when the Beit HaMikdash was still standing, they couldn't force her to take sota water, right? There's a ceremony in the Torah that talks about if a woman is warned by her husband not to be alone with a man, is found to be alone with him. So in the Torah, in the Beit HaMikdash time, she would be given the sota water unless she admitted to it, unless whatever, all the conditions that apply to that, but she'd be fed sota water. The Mishnah says when the Beit Din does the kino, and the Beit Din are the ones who warn her against being alone with the man, that's not that it'll lead to her drinking the sota water, ella the postla miktubata, but it will lose her ktubah if the husband chooses to divorce her, or if the husband maybe is required to divorce her. The Rebbe says, but all those circumstances, if you look at the Mishnah carefully, are a situation where the husband doesn't have the ability to do the kinui himself, to say, and it comes to the word kano, to like be jealous about something, he doesn't have the ability to stand before and say, don't be alone with this man. But, says the Rebbe, we've never found that if the husband is here, and he's choosing not to. Now, he would be wrong for choosing not to. That's fine. But that doesn't confer, as far as we know in Halacha, a power on the court to do it instead of him. In that Mishnah, when the Mishnah says the court can do so, it's because the Mishnah is assuming that the court can do it on his behalf when he's able to, and the Mishnah is assuming, as Rashi says there in the Gemara, that this is an example of Zachin La'adam Shalom B'fanav, that when there's something that is a merit for somebody else, or does a help to somebody else, you can do that even when he's not around to ratify it. So for the easy example, the one that comes to mind, is if I want to deposit money in somebody else's bank account, halakhically, I am easily able to do that because getting more money is, by and large, seen as a merit, as a value to that person. If the person stands and says, I don't want it, that's a different situation, right? We don't force people to accept things that, usually, to accept things that are in there, that are there to their benefit, and maybe there are some people who don't want any more money for some reason, but we're allowed to assume on various issues that if it's a merit for them, it's something they'll, by and large, people want, we can do that even without them there to consent. So when the husband is unable to be mekane, is unable to warn the wife against hanging out with a man with whom she seems to be having an affair, there the Beit Din has the ability to do so. But they don't have their own independent ability. The ability to do so is a matter of them being the implicit messengers of the husband. And if you look at the Gemara there, it says, Stama Demilta. It's generally to be assumed that since she's violating the practice of Jewish women, and the practice of Jewish women, as far as the Mishnah elsewhere says it, is that women don't promiscuously hang out with other men, right? Whether or not that leads to actual sexual relations, it's dot Moshe, it's dot Yisrael, it's the ways of Jewish women not to act in ways that could lead one to suspect there was an affair is being had. So the Gemara says that Stama Demilta are general assumptions to be that since she's violating dot Moshe Yisrael, I forget which one, but she's violating the Jewish way of acting, so then we can assume that the husband would want the court to warn her, even though he's not able to do so. But since it's true that if a husband chooses to stay with his wife even after she's violated the Jewish way of women acting, that's in his power. It may not be recommended, but that's in his power. Courts do not force couples to split up just because the wife is acting inappropriately. The wife's having an affair that everybody knows about, that would be a different situation, but that's not what we're talking about. So therefore it says, and we've seen on other occasions, and I never remember the dates because I don't do these in order. I don't record these in order. I am now making up for the first year I did them when I recorded them much more in order, but these are making up for the days that were Friday and Shabbos of the previous year, so I certainly don't record them in order, but I remember there was a time when we pointed out the halacha is that we don't even prohibit women from staying with their husbands if they had yichud, if they really were alone with another man in a situation where theoretically sexual relations could have occurred. We need more evidence than that before we require couples to split up. So here, the question is going to be, says the note of Yehuda, your kinoi, your warning her, matters not at all because you weren't relative, you weren't able to be messenger of the husband. Why not? Because the husband didn't want it. Because the husband had the ability to warn her against being alone with him, the ability to kick the man out of the house, and he chose not to. He may be wrong for choosing not to, but that's not the question. The question, by formal legal standards, is: did the court have the power to do a kinoi, to warn her in this way that had legal ramifications? And if they didn't, then there has been no legal warning here, and therefore the fact that she was alone with him would not therefore lose her anything, because they didn't do any meaningful kinoi from a legal standpoint. Then he adds, by the way, a new idea of his. This is an idea of his, obviously, based on another new idea that he had. So he says, Il male de mistafina. If I wasn't a little embarrassed to advance so much a new idea, I would say, he says, that even were we to think that you had the power. Or let's say, say it better, I should say it better the way he says it, which is, even in those cases where the Mishnah gives the Beit Din the power to create the kinui, to create the warning on the women, with the legal ramifications, that if she then is alone with that man, she loses her ketubah, because then enough evidence has been gathered that loses her ketubah payment and gives the husband the right to divorce her with cause, as it were, or prejudicially, with her losing out legally. Now, if you suggest that the husband gets out of prison, let's say, or recovers from illness, whatever it was that incapacitated him, says, no, I didn't want that kinui. So then too, Notabuta suggests, it doesn't count as a kinoi. Why not? Because the whole basis of the kinoi was, we assume that her action is sufficiently problematic that of course the husband wants a kinoi, wants us to tell her, you know, you better not be alone with that guy, and if you are, there's going to be consequences, so that's why we do it. But if he turns out, now this comes back to the whole thing that I said before, quickly, but let me say it again a little more slowly. When we say zachin l'adam shelo b'fanav, that we can give somebody a merit, shelo b'fanav, when he's not around, that means those situations where we assume that something is a merit, that something is a benefit, that something is what people would want, such as money. But if after the fact the person comes and says, that's not a benefit for me, I did not want you to ever do that, in fact, you've harmed me in some way, or I just don't want it, then that doesn't work. It's not like we can force benefits on people. It's that we're allowed to assume that it's seen as a benefit. Here too, even in the case where the Mishnah says we're allowed to assume that it's a benefit, if he comes out and he says, no, it's not a benefit to me, Rabbi Yehuda thinks there's at least a good possibility that we're not that when we would say the kina didn't take effect, and so we say that the problem here is that we're not sure, and it would be true of other cases as well, but we're not sure if at the moment that it happened he would have agreed that it wasn't a benefit. Meaning, what if it's true that he didn't like, he wouldn't have liked that he known about it, or if he was in prison, let's say, and we never didn't consult with him, but had he known about it, he didn't like the way his wife was acting. He liked the idea of a kinui, of us warning her not to be alone with that guy. But the reason he liked it was he thought it would stop her from doing it. Once she did it anyway, and she was alone with him, and now he's going to basically have to divorce her, it might be that he doesn't want to. So it might be that when he comes and says, no, I never wanted you to do the kinui, so he never told us what he wanted or didn't want, but we need to know that at the original time he didn't want it. Because if at the original time he did want it, he can't go back on it later, right? Once you appoint a messenger, the messenger does what you wanted them to do, you can't retroactively uproot it. So if she was warned, then you can't uproot that. So that's why nobody's not sure about it. He fundamentally thinks that when we assume that an idea or an item or an action is a merit, is a benefit to a person, and therefore we can do it without their consent, that assumption is only good for as long as the other person doesn't say, no, it's not a benefit. But if the person says after the fact that it's not a benefit, so then it's more complicated, because then it might have thought of it as a benefit at the time, and they realize later he or she didn't like it. So, but certainly, regardless of that discussion, he says, certainly when at the moment that we're doing it, the husband is right there in front of us, and he's not doing it himself, then what would lead us to think that the Beit Din, the court, has the right to assume that they're serving as his messengers? Adding to that, even more so, at the time, the husband and the wife were warned together about this issue, and it's not just that they didn't act on it. Netnu katef soreret, they like repudiated it. They said, there's nothing going on here. You're being, you know, grandmothers, not to blame grandmothers, but that's the phrase in English, right? You're being overly cautious and overly worried about our conduct. We're fine. So then there's really no room to assume that the husband wants us to do a formal kinui such that she would then run the risk of being divorced against her will at financial prejudice. And then he has another problem with what they did. They sent messengers to perform the kinui. But if you look at the language of the Shulchan Aruch about the cases where the Mishnah Sota discusses the court taking to themselves the right to do a kinui to warn her against being alone with a certain man, Shulchan Aruch says about those cases, if somebody, you know, became a deaf mute, or they lost their mind, or they're in prison, and the court hears about it, they call her to court. So the Shulchan Aruch says that the court calls for her to come. Why didn't it say the court sends to her? So he thinks that it might be that the court is required to do it themselves. Why are they required to do it themselves? Why can't they send the messenger? He says two reasons that come to his mind. One is, because even with the husband, he, Rabbi Yehuda, has concerns or issues or questions about whether he can make a shaliach for kinui. For this procedure of telling the woman, I suspect that you're in a bad situation. I suspect that you're behaving inappropriately with this man. Now, Rita thinks that it might be that he's required to do it personally, and that would be one of the exceptional examples where he's not able to create a messenger for that. And most things in halacha, one can do it oneself or one can do it through a messenger. He thinks as an example, maybe not. Why does he think that? He thinks that because there's a Russian gittin, where Russian gittin says that in situations where, and this is more well accepted than what the notary was about to say, the Russian gittin says, if let's say somebody owes one of me money, and I decide to get that money, meaning I'm allowed to take that money because it's owed to me. So there's a whole situation about what I do have to go to court, what I don't have to go to court. We're not going to get into that now. But I'm being toe-faced lebalchov. Somebody owes me money. I'm taking possession of items to repay that loan. So I'm allowed to do that in some situations. But where there are other people involved who will be adversely affected by my doing this, so for example, let's say this borrower owes money to other people as well. So when I take some of his possessions to pay back my loan, I am limiting or reducing their ability to collect their loan. So that is, the Rush says, is not allowed to be done by messenger. I can't be chav la'acherim. I can't cause other people problems by messenger. So the Nevi Yehuda thought that applied to Kinui as well, because in Kinui, in telling her that she better not be alone with that man, he's causing her an adverse judicial situation. He is creating a situation where she is at financial risk of losing her ketubah if she then goes ahead and is alone with it, and is found alone with this man by all through a messenger. And the Nevi Yehuda thinks that is part of this same principle, that one is not allowed to act by messenger in a way that has adverse effect for somebody outside of that messenger-ship situation. And therefore, he thinks that even back in the time of the Gemara, when men could divorce their wives against their will, we no longer do that because of Chirin B'Kinu Gershom, but the Gemara thought that men were able to even divorce their wives against their will. The Notabuta says, even back then, that wasn't through a messenger. Why couldn't you do it through a messenger? Because divorcing her is clearly an adverse experience for her in most situations. If it's against her will, it's clearly an adverse situation. And that you can't do against somebody else's will, meaning by messenger. Meaning everybody's saying he's got a broad idea that actions that one is not able in halacha, in general halacha, to appoint a messenger in cases that have adverse effects for people outside of the messenger relationship. He notes that many people had a problem with this idea, and the sages of the generation had written him letters trying to argue this position, but he feels that he correctly and appropriately answered all of them, and therefore is comfortable with this idea. So therefore, he doesn't think the Beit Din could do it by a messenger either, because even the whole husband couldn't do it by a messenger. More than that, he also thinks, I'm sorry, so that should theoretically undermine the whole Mishnah's idea, right? He's been working on the assumption, the Mishnah assuming, is saying that the husband, that the court becomes a messenger of the husband, mistama, right? We get to assume the husband would want the court to do this on his behalf. He says that's a specific verse in the Torah that enlightens us. That's a possibility. There's Gemara in Kosot that we don't have to get into. But it's not, but it's an exception to this general rule, and you needed a verse in the Torah to tell you that exception. So that's issue number one. Why a court could not appoint this messenger, he thinks, because he thinks messengers like this cannot be appointed because they're causing adverse situations for other people. The second answer he gives is that he thinks that even if it were true that the husband could create a messenger, let's say that a novel idea of his is not true, or let's say this is an exception for some reason, the court can't because they're messengers. And we have a principle in halacha that ain shliach ose shliach, that a messenger cannot generally make another messenger. It's called a principle in halacha called the mile lomimser l'shliach, that words can't be, meaning a power that's just conferred by words, cannot then be conferred on somebody else. Now he says, obviously I know as well as anybody else, there's a big debate about that principle, about whether mile lomimser l'shliach. That's why I gave my first reason as well. So all that is prelude to his real complaints. Right, says prelude to his real complaint. Sorry, he says that I don't think also that even if I gave you, granted you, that you would create a kinui, that you would create a situation where if she seemed to have been alone with him in a way where they could have had actual sexual relations, that she would then be prohibited to your husband and he would be able to divorce her, would be required to divorce her without paying her ketubah. I don't think you have nearly enough evidence for that. Now I need to go through some of the evidence that they do have to see how much the Notabi Huda is resisting saying they have evidence for it. So the first testimony they got was lots and lots of people said that they occasionally come into the house, you know, all of a sudden, Nobody else is there other than these two people. They're sitting together, b'cheder, and alone in a room, b'chibuk v'nishuk. Now, chibuk v'nishuk means kissing and hugging. In our terms, we say they catch them making out. And nobody says, still doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? First of all, you never tell me, and there's going to be a complaint of this throughout, the court that sent in the letter didn't put dates on it. He actually complains, elsewhere, I won't say it again, when we get up to it, he complains that he thinks they're required to get dates on all of these things. They didn't. I'm not sure they didn't, or they just didn't report to the Notary Behuda. But he again and again will say, I don't know that was after the kinui, unless it's after the kinui, unless it's after the warning from the Beit Din, it's irrelevant information to us, because it's only once she's been warned that her actions can then put her in an adverse situation. So that's first issue is, you didn't tell me the time of it. Second issue is, you haven't given me evidence that they were alone together long enough for the standard of what halakha, how halakha defines how you know that an act of sexual relations could occur, which is the time it takes to fry an egg and to swallow it. So whatever that time is, I think we usually think, we do this at weddings in a much more positive context, I think we think it's like 8 or 9 minutes is what the time that we give to it. Might be a little bit less, a little bit more, but the point is, you have no evidence. So what he's basically saying is, I walk into a house, you know, me and another witness walk into a house, we find a couple there, and they're making out in a way that would seem like something's going on. We don't know how long they've been there. So we don't know if they've been there 9 or 10 minutes in time for that. So that's the first testimony that he rejects. Second testimony he rejects is that there were various things, what we would call today maybe PDAs, public displays of affection. They did in public, but they weren't alone together. A third witness did see, now there's only one witness, third witness did see that they went distant from the house into a dark place, and they were there like a half an hour. So nobody says, yeah, you're right, that's an eight steer. That's one witness for them having been alone together. But you didn't ask him from the testimony they said, you didn't ask him when. Maybe it wasn't after the kinui. So I'm putting all these out because I want to just show you how much evidence there was that they had an affair that he's refusing to accept because of legal technicalities. So it's worth paying attention to and thinking about. I'm not going to go further with it because A, I'm running out of time, and B, I have nothing, I have no proof of why he's going so far, but it bears noticing. Fourth testimony was they saw him sitting on her bed, his left arm under her head, meaning basically they were snuggling, as it were, but other people in the room too, right? Her maid was also in the bed, you know, lying on the other side of the bed. So that's not a steer, that's not being alone together. And then somebody else saw that at night, he got up, this guy, from where he was sleeping, he put out the candle, and the guy watched, he said, and he saw that the man went to her bed, but he didn't see her lie down on the bed with her. That's what Notary Behuda says. So that's not full testimony. A fifth testimony was about Znut Mamish, saw them having actual relations, but it was a woman, and we don't take women's testimony in these kinds of situations for these situations. Sixth testimony was hearsay, meaning it was a one witness from another witness, which is also not valid in halacha. And therefore, so I am in no way questioning the Notary Behuda's halachic construction of the legal validity of all these claims. But I could imagine somebody else putting them all together and saying, we at least have key or here, we at least have this, we have at least have that. We'll get to that a little bit. But it fundamentally, he seems invested in pointing out to them that they have not found out the information they would need to find out to fully force a divorce. And that's the piece I think that's most problematic with him, that they're planning on forcing the couple divorced. And therefore he says, I don't find anything in this testimony that allows us to say that because of the kinui and the stira, because of their actions, which he wasn't happy with to begin with, because he didn't think it should have been a real kinui, because he didn't think that was their power to warn her. So therefore he says, I don't think you have testimony here. And you've decided to force the couple to separate, I find that very difficult. I think you've made great mistakes. You're causing a woman to be separated from her husband. That seems to me to be essential to him and crucial to him in that he doesn't like what they're doing, and you haven't done the proper investigation. You need a drisha of a hakira. You need the real investigation. Now that's, by the way, even though he, Notary Behuda, does hold that if they don't know the answers to certain questions, that doesn't hurt the testimony, but you must ask the question. Unless you do, you haven't taken proper testimony from the witnesses. So if the kinui is not going to work and the stira is not going to work, maybe just the rumors about her, maybe just the information that we do know about her is good enough, because the Shulchan Aruch does say that if there's rumors about a woman and there's enough improper activity on her part, even though it's not, doesn't rise to the extent of full sexual relations, that might be enough as well. So he says, well, you have to find out if the rumors about her were spreading even after the kinui, the warning happened. Meaning, the warning was there, but we usually require the rumors be after they've been warned not to be together, even was it a kinui. But if it wasn't after, then you don't have anything, because you have a lot of evidence that maybe an affair was about to happen, but you don't have evidence that it did happen after the time that you warned them. Meaning, let's say there's an affair that we can't prove that happened beforehand, then you warned her, and she continued doing negative things, but not things that rise to the level of kiyur, then we can't say that she has to get divorced from her husband. And then he reviews the fact that, again, all of his testimony, the third witness was a problem, but that witness, we don't have a date on it, right? You have a lot of testimony, a lot of evidence that she's about to have an affair, but we don't have anything that says she did have an affair. And he once again says, how can we, on the basis of lack of information and a doubt, force a woman to divorce her husband? And this is especially true, he says now, and maybe this also played in a factor for him, she's pregnant. So you're going to get him, forcing her divorced, which back then I assume was really, really difficult for a woman to be a single mother, I'm pretty sure, and I think the Rodney might have been resisting that. And he's claiming when we force divorce, it's almost always where there are no children. Where there are children, we don't do that. And many Achronim had a problem with the whole idea of forcing a divorce when there are children involved. So fundamentally, he doesn't think there's enough room to force a divorce, and the husband doesn't seem to want to divorce her. So he thinks that. But then he says, but I rethought it. I rethought it, he says, because you wrote to me that it would be a terrible chilul Hashem. It would be a terrible sacrilege of Hashem's name, blasphemy of Hashem's name. It would make a terrible impression among the populace if they saw a woman who the Beit Din had decided had committed an affair, and that they had decided that you couldn't stay married to your husband, and they had separated them, and now they're going to go back, because they're going to write to the notary, and he says, nope, it was okay. So he doesn't really mean it's okay. He means that there's not quite enough information to force this terrible woman to separate from her husband, especially because she's pregnant. We don't want to cause that situation. But people at large won't get that impression. People at large will get the impression that a woman had an affair. Until now, you know, the rumor has been that when women have affairs that are proven affairs, they cannot stay with their husband, and they cannot marry the man with whom they had the affair. All of a sudden, you're going to have her stay with her husband. So they wrote to me, it's going to be real chilul Hashem if you rule against us. So, of course, part of his answer, one of his responses, I don't like that you put me in this situation, right? He's that part of why he's being so harsh with them about the mistake they made in separating the couple. So he says, I found another way to say that maybe he does have to divorce her. And the way to say it is that they had written to him that the husband in court testified that he spoke to her and alone. And he said, you know what, admit the truth. And maybe, you know, maybe you can redeem yourself in some way. Maybe Hashem will forgive you for something. This is sort of, he had this conversation with her, which got interesting, where her husband says, you know, at least you can redeem yourself a little bit. And he gets her to tell him what he thinks is the truth. And she admitted, and she said, yeah, I had an affair with the guy. So, mashmashu ma'amin ledvaret, sounds like he believes her. So if he believes her, he's now made her to him what's called shavya anafshe chaticha de isura. He turned her into a prohibited item for himself, meaning as far as he construes the truth, as far as he understands the truth, she's had an affair. When a woman's had an affair, she's not allowed, the couple is not allowed halakhically to stay together. Now, the problem with that is that we generally today no longer allow men to make such claims. The Rama writes in Shulchan Aruch that since the time of Cherem Debeinu Gershom, remember, Cherem Debeinu Gershom is a term we use for a lot of communal customs that arose about various issues, including divorce. One was you can't divorce a woman against her will. Another one was you can't take two wives. So that means that those men who choose to be guided by Cherem Debeinu Gershom, sadly, in our days, there are men who just choose not to be, and they'll find a fake way to marry women other than their husbands. Sorry, to marry women other than their wives. Meaning they'll find fake ways to get another wife into their thing so they won't be bothered by the Cherem Debeinu Gershom. So some of those men might hit on the planet to say, I think she had an affair. I believe she had an affair. That's a shavya. It'll make her prohibit him, and they'll have to divorce her, and we'll require them to get divorced because they can't stay together anymore. So that would be a way around for him. So the Ramah writes, we don't allow that. And we give him makos, right? We put him in nidu. We sort of ban him a little bit, that he is trying to find a way to get around the Cherem Debeinu Gershom. So how come here the Notary Bute is going to allow it? So obviously we know that he's reaching for some way to do it because he thinks he has to avoid the Chilul Hashem. But he says that's only true if she's otherwise a perfectly fine wife. But now a situation where she clearly, it's well established that she's overt al-dat, that she has violated the ordinary Jewish way of acting, and we have testimony for that, and we have testimony that she was hugging and kissing while she was secluded alone with the man, even if it doesn't rise to the level of letting her be considered to have had stira with him. And we have two witnesses that they, you know, they were in bed together at night, even though we don't know what happened after that, after a Beit Din warned her, even though they shouldn't have warned her. He thinks that's enough to say that the husband is in fact required to separate from her, and that would be enough to say that the couple has to separate. So that's really his conclusion. But of course, if that's the way we're doing it, and it's a question of shavya nafshi, and it's really because the husband says he believes her, then it's much harder to know whether or not he has to pay off her ketubah. Because from the technical legal standpoint, she wasn't required to get divorced, because from the technical legal standpoint, she hadn't yet done all that which would be required in order to rise to the level of getting divorced against her will. So maybe he has to pay her ketubah. But that's fundamentally where the Nodabita comes out on this question. It's, to me, a beautiful example of watching the formalisms of halacha at play. The only question is why he was so invested in those formalisms when it seems to me there's lots and lots of evidence this woman in fact was having an affair. But it could be just a dedication to formalism of halakha, that's certainly a possibility. Or it might be that the factors here of her being pregnant and of the court trying to force husband and wife to separate might have played in his head as well. Whatever the answer is, it teaches a lot about these kinds of situations, and the Nota Buda has enlightened us for the 23rd of Iyar. This has been a responsive day. Rabbi Jacob Ramitz, David Hachas, and the OU are part of putting this out there for you. We should thank them. My name is Gideon Rothstein. I bid you a good day.